It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Central Time, if you've planted a garden this year, had a cup of coffee today, worn something cotton, or eaten just about anything, you have seeds to thank for it. Our guest shares the science of seeds coming up. First, the University of Wisconsin System's Board of Regents is voting on their budget today, but in a departure from previous years, they didn't publicly disclose the details ahead of the meeting. Karen Herzog, higher education reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, is at the meeting now. She joined us earlier in the day for a preview. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, not so much the budget itself, but the release of budget details in advance. They're not releasing them much in advance. Is that unusual? Do we usually see this information a day or two ahead of time?
Yes, it's very unusual. In fact, previous years, UW System has made a point of walking reporters through the budget just to make sure that if we have questions, we understand it and can write clearly for our readers. And this year, the plan was to have us do that on Wednesday to at least see the budget in advance so that we could report to our readers, you know, what the seg fee increases that were proposed for various campuses, what the total budget was, and what the cash balances have dropped to, those controversial cash balances that lawmakers were so upset about in 2013, the money that campuses and UW System had set aside, you know, for emergencies, for unexpected shortfalls, things like that, but they did not provide clear transparency about how much was there and where it was going.
You know, when a movie studio doesn't let critics see the movie in advance, that's usually a bad sign about the quality of the movie. Was there any indication about why the UW System didn't release these numbers in advance?
Well, they're very careful about the way the information is presented. I think there's this desire on their part to control, I should say, maybe I hate to say the word spin, but to control the message, to make sure that it's presented in the way they want it to be presented. And of course, the Regents meetings are webcast, so they can speak directly to their audience. And I think that was just kind of talking about the messaging and not being quite ready to let it go yet. However, that can backfire because when you don't talk about the budget, it gives the impression that there's something that's being hidden, and it really lacks transparency for the public to know what's going on ahead of when the regents actually vote on it.
Now, you have seen the budget at this point. I'm sure it's big, but anything strike you right off the bat in looking at it?
Well, I think that the key discussion is segregated fees that students pay. And these are the fees that are on top of tuition that cover things like, you know, student unions, rec facilities, all the student organizations that campuses have. And tuition for undergrad residents is frozen, so that can't go up. But seg fees, these fees that students pay on top of tuition, are going up and have gone up in recent years despite the tuition freeze. So seg fees will be a big topic of conversation. The across-the-board average for all the campuses is an increase of $59. And generally, seg fees are, you know, roughly in the range of $1,000 a year on top of tuition. Just a little less than half of that is related to, like, building projects, not necessarily new ones, but, you know, it takes 30 years to pay off, you know, a new student union or whatever. The largest increases are UW La Crosse. That's a $259 increase. And UW-Madison is seeking a $72 increase, and a big part of that is to add counselors for mental health services. Student government has been seeking an increase in that because of student health concerns about how are students doing with anxiety and depression and all of those things that are part of college experience sometimes.
Are these segregated fees usually, are they seen as controversial as maybe a backdoor tuition increase despite that tuition freeze you mentioned?
That is how they are perceived by the public, because if you're not raising tuition, you're still finding a way to get more money out of students is sort of the public perception of that. However, there are very specific things that those fees may be used for, and they are for specific student benefits. And then students actually vote for a new student union or whatever the project may be. They actually vote on that to see whether they want to increase their fees, although the voting is typically a very small percentage of students. Now you can actually look at the budget and find out very clearly, you know, what each part of that seg fee increase is to go toward, you know, whether it's to go toward a building, a service, or whatever. They very clearly spell that out, and that is part of what UW System says is increased transparency.
Talking to Karen Herzog from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a new budget in front of UW Regents today. Another point of controversy in the past, some lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, very upset about fund balances, reserve funds held by the UW system as a whole, which is really just, the individual schools, and you sum it all together. That was seen as excessive in the past. What are you seeing in this new budget?
Well, fund balances will be down a net total of $75 million from a year ago. Now, they are going to spend about $160 million of that carryover money to help balance this upcoming budget. And the budget itself for the next fiscal year is actually larger than last year's. And a lot goes into that, and it's a very complicated explanation that I won't get into. But it's basically $37.4 million higher than last year's budget. It's $6.23 billion. An interesting figure they tossed out was that's $2.5 billion more than in 1994-95.
That may strike people as odd. State funding, we heard a lot about the state funding cuts in the most recent two-year budget. I know you said it's complicated, but obviously if the budget's going up, that's coming from other sources apart from state funding and from in-state tuition increases, which they can't do?
Yes. It's a large share of it comes from pass-through federal financial aid. So the money goes to the institution, to the students, to help them cover the cost, but it has to be accounted for within the budget because it does pass through. So there are a lot of things that go into that. The state support is down. As you know, we had a biennial budget cut for the UW system. Those approved last summer for a total of $250 million over 2 years. So there is less state funding, but the state also pays ongoing base expenses. And again, it's very complicated. But generally speaking, the state funding is still down. The budget is up for a number of complicated reasons.
We've mentioned political controversy related to the UW system budget in recent years. Seems like from your reporting that isn't going to change. Republicans and Democrats watching this, using it as a political football. Do you expect to see response from lawmakers in coming days?
Absolutely. Even before the budget was released, because reporters and others expected that it would be released yesterday, even before it was released, we had lawmakers sending unsolicited statements to reporters, you know, without whatever their perspective may be, whether it's, you know, blasting Republican lawmakers and part of the Democrats, you know, for the state of UW system funding, or the Republicans saying, hey, you know, we saved families all this money with the tuition freeze over the last 2 years. The number that's tossed out is about $6,000 over 4 years savings for families with the tuition freeze.
We'll leave it there for now. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That was Karen Herzog with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to her earlier today to preview the UW system budget. The Board of Regents is considering the details of that budget this afternoon. You might be watching those seedlings you planted earlier this summer grow in your garden. Maybe you're watching weeds take over the garden now. And while you're doing that, you might be drinking some coffee, eating a bagel or toast or other bread-like substance. Maybe you're wearing something made of cotton. One thing ties them all together. They're the consequences of an amazing transformation in the plant kingdom hundreds of millions of years ago, seeds. Our next guest dug deep into the past, present, and future of seed-bearing plants. Tor Hansen is a conservation biologist. His latest book is out in paperback. It's called The Triumph of Seeds, How Grains, Nuts, Kernels, Pulses, and Pips Conquered the Plant Kingdom and Shaped Human History. Tor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, you write that seeds are crucial to us humans. Maybe no seeds, no civilization as we know it. How much do we depend on plants that have seeds?
Well, they're the basis of so much of our diet, and that is sort of the obvious one. We think, well, we care about seeds because we eat them. But it goes so much deeper than that, and you mentioned some of the examples in your introduction. When we start to look around, we realize we're encountering seeds in our daily lives all day, from the pajamas we wear at night to the coffee that wakes us up in the morning to the cup of cocoa before bed, and everything from pharmaceuticals to biofuels and all sorts of things in between, all products of seeds.
Now, plants aren't producing these seeds out of, you know, a spirit of generosity toward humans, as I understand it. From the standpoint of evolution, what's in it for them?
Well, the seed is a remarkable evolutionary invention that came from the spore plants. They evolved from the spore plants, so things like ferns and mosses that were the dominant plants in all terrestrial habitats, really, before seeds came along. The seeds evolved from them and developed several key traits that gave them a great advantage in reproduction, colonizing new habitats, that sort of thing. One of those traits that we're so familiar with is the fact that seeds contain nutrition for the baby plant, so that when the seed germinates, all of the energy for the initial burst of growth comes from the seed itself. And that was a terrific innovation that really helped seeds get established in all sorts of habitats. And there are several others as well, from the defense of seeds to their adaptations for dispersal to their remarkable ability to endure in a dormant state in the soil. All of those things were evolutionary novelties when seeds came up with them, and together they gave the seed plants a tremendous advantage over spore plants, so that now it's the seed plants that dominate our flora and the spore plants that are the minor players.
That endurance, you have a story in the book about that. A seed found in the ruins of Masala that's stored there about 2 millennia ago, lost amidst a Roman siege and a fire. Tell us about that seed and what happened to it.
Oh, it's a marvelous story. It's the story of a wonderful little date pit, the seed of a date palm that was part of the food stores in this incredible fortress called Masada, which is a very important place in Israel. It's the site of a siege where the Romans had surrounded some Jewish rebels 2,000 years ago, and eventually the fortress fell, but there was the rebels, rather than surrendering to the Romans, they many of them at least committed suicide. So it's a very important cultural site, and it was excavated with great detail and attention during the 1960s, and one of the things they found was all of these food stores, including a bunch of Judean dates that were so well preserved, there were still scraps of flesh on these dates. And they put them, you know, in a collection someplace. But a few years ago, some botanists got a hold of several of these ancient date seeds and planted them in the soil. And lo and behold, one of them had survived all that time, and it sprouted and grew into a healthy Judean date palm.
Amazing. 2,000 years from Masada till now, and they were able to grow this. That's not the norm for seeds, but they are pretty impressive in their endurance and hardiness, aren't they?
Yeah, so the Masada date palm, which they've named Methuselah, and it's a very special plant now, because that variety of date had gone extinct in the interim, so they're able to start bringing it back now. But that's an extreme example, but it's something that seeds do all the time. Many, many kinds of seeds go dormant, and much of our agricultural and food distribution systems depend on that. These seeds can be stored for months until the next planting season. They can be stored for years and decades in some cases, and grains can be stored for months, even years before we eat them. So that incredible ability of seeds to go dormant is really something we take for granted, but we couldn't live the way we do without it.
And speaking of preserving seeds, you visited vaults, and I guess they exist around the world, trying to preserve biodiversity, a lot of different kind of seeds, and efforts to gather up more and more heirloom seeds as well. What's the effort like to keep these seeds around?
Right. Well, there is a great effort now, the seed banking movement, and there's a famous sort of backup bank that many seed banks around the world are sending duplicate copies to up in Svalbard in Norway, a vault where even if the power goes out, it's so dry and cold and dark in this mountainside vault that seeds will persevere there for a long time. And the idea behind this movement is to try to preserve, number one, a lot of the diversity of agricultural crops that we have developed through our farming over thousands of years, but have begun to lose as we have changed our farming practices from growing many different varieties of any one crop into just a few varieties grown on a mass scale. And so we realize now that in losing that diversity, we're losing the ability to perhaps resist disease or breed new varieties. We're losing a lot of our agricultural heritage. So there's a great effort underway to preserve as many of those crop varieties and the wild ancestors of crops so that we have all of this genetic diversity that we're going to need for the future, which is particularly important in a changing world where climates are changing, growing conditions are changing, and we're going to need to adapt to that.
So these seed archives might give us the food crops we need after climate change affects a certain growing area.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I had a conversation with Chris Walters, the director of our National Seed Bank in Fort Collins, and I asked her about climate change, and her answer to me was sorghum. And I said, what do you mean sorghum? And she said, that is the hot country grain. It was a grain domesticated in Africa and hot places. It grows well in dry and very warm conditions. And as many agricultural regions get warmer and drier, the thought is that we'll be growing a lot more sorghum than we do today. And so the seed bank in Fort Collins has 40,000 different samples of sorghum seed stored there so that we have that diversity of sorghum types that hopefully we'll find one that grows well when we need it.
We're talking to Tor Hansen about his book, The Triumph of Seeds. And Tor, one seed that's crucial to the continued existence of Wisconsin Public Radio is coffee. And I wonder, why did coffee, along with a couple of other plants, develop this substance that's such a useful stimulant for us humans?
Yeah, oh, it's a very, very essential seed. I probably should have listed coffee as a co-author on that book, as a matter of fact. But it is essentially what we use as a stimulant. The caffeine found in coffee is part of the chemical defense system of that seed. You know, because seeds have this nutrition for the baby plant found within, everything wants to eat that, right? We eat seeds and all sorts of creatures in the wild, from birds to insects and everything in between, wants at all of that energy and nutrition in there. So plants have been evolving chemical defenses to defend not only their leaves and other parts of the plant, but particularly their seeds for millions of years. And in caffeine, they came across what is essentially a natural pesticide developed by the plant that's effective against hornworms and various other sorts of attackers. Fungal attacks and things like that can be slowed down or warded off by caffeine. So that's why it's in there, and we use it as a stimulant. And because we're so fond of it, the coffee bean, seed of a shrubby little African tree, is now the world's second most traded commodity. Only oil futures generate more annual revenue than the trade in coffee beans. And given the price of oil right now, I wonder if coffee beans might have the edge.
And there's a similar story with chili peppers. This hot stuff is to keep away certain animals that would consume the seeds, but allows others, birds, I think you're right, to eat them no problem.
Yeah, isn't it marvelous? You get into these examples, and there are these wonderful stories about evolution and adaptation in a particular environment. But for the chili pepper, you know, we get this hot rush from the capsaicin, an alkaloid that is involved there. And it's specifically designed, really, over evolutionary time. It has evolved to drive away people, you know, and other mammals, because mammals feel that burn. It overrides our senses in a way that tells us that there's actual damage being done, that we're being burned, when in fact we're not. It's a false alarm, but it gets us to stop eating them. If we are, for example, a little mouse or a rodent that would chew up those seeds and destroy them. But what's fascinating is that birds don't feel it at all. They have a different system, and to them, the seeds are flavorless. But the seeds pass right through a bird. Whereas a mouse would chew it up and destroy the seed, the seeds, when the birds eat those little chili peppers, they digest the fruity bits, and the seeds pass through unharmed and are dispersed by the birds as they fly about the landscape.
And speaking of rodents, I learned in your book that rats, They have teeth that can help them chew through the concrete we humans think will protect, you know, grain silos and other things. And they have that. They evolved that to chew through tough seed husks. And that's another one of these evolutionary arms races. Could you talk through that story?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I got to thinking, you know, you read these stories all the time about how, you know, rats have chewed into, you know, some tight space and then destroyed a bunch of electrical cords and started a fire or something like that. And they're rats, you know, chewing through concrete and other really hard things, aluminum, things that we think will keep them out. And I thought, well, that's fascinating, but why on earth should a rat be able to chew through concrete? What an absurd notion. And the belief is, and the evidence points to, a co-evolution between rodents like rats and plants in the defense of their seeds, so that you see increasingly hard shells in many plants that are particular favorites of the rodents, and the shells get thicker and thicker and harder to keep rats out. But in some cases, it's more nuanced than that, in that the plants don't necessarily want the rats to leave the seeds alone entirely. For example, rodents like squirrels are wonderful dispersers of nuts. And in this case, they're still attracted. They want that nut. But what the husk does is it slows them down. They can't just sit underneath, you know, a nut tree and devour all the nuts right there, because it takes them a long time to chew through them. And they're vulnerable there to predators, to raptors and owls and cats and things that know darn well it's a good place to hunt for rodents is underneath a nut tree. So the rodents, instead of eating them on the spot, they have to take them away from the tree. They have to disperse them. And many of them have this charming habit called scatter hoarding, where the animals bury the seeds so that they can come back and find them later and chew through that hard shell in safety. And so in doing this, then the nut tree is sacrificing a certain number of its seeds with the hope that some of them will be forgotten in the soil, or the squirrel will get picked off by an owl and will never go back and eat up those scatter hoarded nuts, and they're planted and ready to sprout.
Thanks to Tor Hatzin for sharing stories from his book, The Triumph of Seeds. It's out in paperback. Summer is finally here, which means we all have good reason to spend more time outdoors. There will be plenty of festivals for people of all ages in the state this summer. Our next guest wrote up a guide of everything from local fairs to big city music festivals. We want to know what festivals you're looking forward to this summer. Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us if you'll be going to your local town fair, who you're going with, what you enjoy about it most, and don't forget the county and state fairs, too. Maybe you're going to Summerfest in Milwaukee. Tell us which artist you're looking forward to seeing. Again, the number is 800-642-1234. Joining us now in our Milwaukee studio is Chelsea Lewis. Chelsea writes about travel and things to do in Wisconsin for Wisconsin Trails and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Chelsea, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start in the short term here. What's coming up this weekend?
Oh, there's so much to do all over the state. Here in Milwaukee, we have Pride Fest that's happening this weekend. And then we also have the Locust Street Festival, which is a fun little local festival with a beer run. So there's like a 2-mile run and you drink 4 beers while you're doing it. That's kind of a wacky one. Up in Door County, there's the Door County Lighthouse Festival. So they open up some of the lighthouses that aren't typically open to the public, and they open those for tours, whether via a boat or on land. So that's a really, really fun one as well.
Now, what is it about outdoor festivals that makes them so fun?
Well, I mean, I think being in Wisconsin, we only have a few months to enjoy the outdoors, right? So we take advantage of them as much as we can, and kind of being outside with the carnival games and rides and food and music, there's just something special about those precious few months and enjoying that.
What are some of the most popular ones around the state, the big names?
Well, of course, you know, in Milwaukee here, we are kind of known as the city of festivals. So we have a whole slew of ethnic festivals, from Polish Fest, which is next weekend, to German and Irish Fest, Festa Italiana, and then, of course, the big Kahuna Summer Fest at the end of June and the beginning of July. But all over the state, there's a handful of big festivals. Up in La Crosse, there's a big River Fest in July, where they bring in some big music acts and kind of party along the Mississippi River. That's a really cool one. There's a Pulaski Polka Days in July
of
up
course.
In Pulaski. Yeah, that's a big one if you've never been to that. And then there's a ton of other music festivals. There's like the Hoday Country Festival up in Rhinelander. Of course, Eau Claire's with Justin Vernon that he puts on. This will be the second year, I think, for that one. So yeah, festivals all over the state.
You mentioned Summerfest. Who are some of the acts headlining Summerfest? There's a lot. It's with the biggest music festival in the world, I've heard.
Yeah, so they say. So there are more than 800 national and local acts, I think, across the 11-day festival. Everything from country and rock and roll to, you know, R&B and rap, local acts, national acts. It's always a great festival, always a good time in Milwaukee.
We're talking to Chelsea Lewis. She wrote in Wisconsin Trails about the big summer festivals around the state of Wisconsin this summer, ones to look forward to, ones to get on your schedule. You can join in with your favorite festivals, your favorite summer festivals around the state of Wisconsin, big or small, statewide or local. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Chelsea, I know you have a lot on offer there in the Milwaukee area. Do you try to get out and enjoy some of the, you know, smaller town festivals around the state?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think those have their own special little flavor. And in fact, there's a funny one coming up, I think, next weekend or in a couple weeks in Sparta called Butterfest, which is totally wacky. They celebrate butter. So it's like your typical festival with carnival stuff and music, but then also they have like a buttermilk pancake breakfast and just fun stuff like that. The Muskie Fest up in Hayward is a lot of fun because that's where the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame is. So if you've never been there, it's like this big giant fiberglass muskie. You can walk inside its mouth and it's kind of a wacky little thing, and they celebrate the muskie. So that's a fun one too.
I've got to dig into the archives. There's a festival, I think it was in a town near Sparta, where they had the Gator Fest, named after, I think, a false gator sighting. And the town was so small that they have a parade, but the parade stands still.
Oh, my gosh.
And you walk past it. The spectators walk past because they only have a couple blocks. They don't have enough room to march the parade. If somebody participates on that, call in at 800-642-1234. Yeah, that is a fun one. People get really creative with these around the state, don't they?
Yeah. I think part of it is kind of a community pride thing, and also maybe trying to draw in some tourists. You know, the wackier, the better. There's other big ones like Air Venture, which draws people from all over the country. That's in Oshkosh at the end of July. Another fun one up north are the Lumberjack World Championships. So, you know, people get their Paul Bunyan on and the end of July, but these like professional, you know, lumberjack forestry people come up and do all kinds of competitions up there. That's kind of a fun one.
And there's some hot air balloon ones around the state, speaking of up in the sky. I know Wisconsin Rapids had one, and there's a balloon rally and barbecue rib fest somewhere I think you wrote about.
Yeah, that's up in Wausau. I think that's in July. I'll have to double check on that. But there's also one coming up in Monroe, the Balloon and Blues Festival. And they actually get some like really good blues music acts come in, and then they pair that with some night glows and some other daytime balloon, you know, they set off the hot air balloons. So that's pretty cool. And then actually in Seymour, the home of the hamburger,
right,
they call it, they have a hamburger fest. So they celebrate that. And then they pair it with a balloon rally as well. And at that one, it's kind of wacky. They have, in the past at least, they've had like this ketchup slide. So it's kind of like a water slide, slip and slide type thing, but with ketchup. Yeah.
So dress accordingly.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's bring in our callers now at 800-642-1234. Lynn is on the line in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi.
Hi, Rob. This is the first year that I've been attending fests. We're out politicking with Myron Buckles and going to these little towns and in the parade. It reminds me of when I was 12, and I'm having a really good time. We've been to Westby. We've been to the Broiler Fest in Oliva. We did something in Arcadia, and we will be at Butterfest. And it's fun. On rides I didn't go to when I was 12 and won't go to now that I'm 60. And it's fun. It's a lot of fun. Nice place to bring the kids.
Well, Lynn, politicking got you out there doing this, it sounds like. But are you going to make this a habit now, even when the campaign season's over?
Yeah. I'll bring my kids instead of the candidate. It'll be fun. It's a good time.
Lynn, thank you so much for sharing that. And Chelsea, talk about the sort of all ages aspects of festivals.
Yeah, that's another really great point. It is, most of them are really family friendly and free for the most part. You know, you have to, of course, buy the food and the rides and stuff, but to just walk around and take in the music. And so many of these have children's activities or children friendly music. So yeah, it's really great for all ages.
All right. Thanks so much for that call. We'll go next to Michael in Madison. Michael, hi.
Hey, guys. Thanks for the show. Love WPR. You guys do a great job. I had a question about Alpine Theater. I heard that they're going to open up camping again in the parking lot after the venues this summer. And I suppose I could try to contact the venue, but have you heard anything about that? I knew they used to do it back in the 80s, and then they stopped doing it.
Michael, thanks for the call. So outdoor music performances at Alpine and camping. I don't know about that, Chelsea. Camping in the parking lot?
Yeah, actually, they just announced, I think a couple weeks ago, our music writer reported on this, that they are going to allow camping after the Dave Matthews Band concerts this year. So I think that's like the July 1st or 2nd or right around the beginning of July. So those two concerts, they are going to allow camping again. I know they just started taking reservations. So you can check out their website, I'm sure, and they probably have more information.
Michael, enjoy the concert, whichever one you're going to. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jackie is with us next in Madison. Jackie,
hey.
Hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I always enjoy the Corn Fest in Sun Prairie. In Madison, there's always something to do every weekend during the summer because it's so short. But I love the Corn Fest. I haven't been in a long time, but used to be you'd spend $2, you get a box full of ears of corn. They have salt shakers hanging all over the place, and then buckets of melted butter. And they have a midway and stuff, and it's a lot of fun.
Jackie, thanks so much. At Chelsea, there's nothing like corn on the cob at an outdoor festival.
No, that's so summer. I always associate that with the state fair, but that sounds awesome.
Jackie, thanks so much for that call. That is, I mean, you mentioned the food earlier, Chelsea, but that's a big attraction. You know, there's block parties around Madison and street fairs, and I'm always looking forward to. And there's food. I don't necessarily get to the restaurants, but I hit their carts every year when I get out to the block parties. Do you have some favorite foods to eat at a festival?
Corn on the cob is definitely one of them. Actually, I really love the Cedarburg Strawberry Festival. They have this, they release this strawberry blush wine that people kind of go crazy for every year. That's in a couple of weeks.
That'd be nice on a hot day, I bet.
Yeah, it's really refreshing. That's a really popular festival. It gets pretty busy there. But yeah, just kind of the classics. I always have to get a corn dog when I go to the state fair. I love Saz's fries at Summerfest. But yeah, the cream puffs, of course. That's a summer staple. So yeah.
And at state fair, do you try the deep fried insert something here on a stick every year, whatever the new thing is?
I do try.
Butter, bacon.
Yeah. I do try one new thing. A couple years ago, I actually had an assignment where I had to go to the state fair and try a bunch of the new foods, and we shot some videos on it. They're probably still floating around the internet somewhere, but I wasn't feeling so good at the end of that day, but it was a fun experience.
And you're still monitoring your cholesterol.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm talking to Chelsea Lewis. She recently wrote a guide to summer festivals around the state for Wisconsin Trails, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you try to get out and enjoy the festivals, big or small? Do you have a favorite? Do you want to plug the one in your community? And what do you like to do there, see there, and eat there? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And maybe you need a recommendation from Chelsea. Give a call, 800-642-1234. We're picking up our conversation with Chelsea Lewis. She wrote a guide to summer festivals in Wisconsin for Wisconsin Trails. And you can join in. What festival are you looking forward to the most this summer? Do you like the music festivals, local fairs, art shows, cultural festivals, block parties, food fests, church festivals? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know if there's one you got to get to every year, or maybe ask for recommendations. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Karen from Anago posted there. She says, don't forget to mention the summer-long festival of the Lake Superior Big Top Chautauqua. Can't forget that, Karen. Thank you. We're involved with that at Public Radio. Chelsea, have you made it up there to Big Top Chautauqua ever?
I have not. You know, I've only been up to Bayfield once or twice in the summer, and each time I haven't had a chance to get over there, but that's definitely on my list.
Well, Karen, thanks for that reminder. We'll go back to our callers now with Dan in Wisconsin Rapids. Dan, hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. What do you want to recommend?
Well, Wisconsin Rapids has a cranberry blossom festival every year. This year it's grown to 4 days, but something new that I'm involved in is called the Friends of Rapids Music. It was started up as an online thing for local bands to publicize stuff, but we're having our first music festival on Saturday, and it's free to the public.
That's fantastic, Dana. Where is that music festival?
At Robinson Park in Wisconsin Rapids. There's 7 local bands, and then we got a headliner, Paul Sieber and the Tomorrow Sound.
Okay, from Paul Sieber from Milwaukee. Yeah, I've played in Wisconsin Rapids a couple times at the Balloon Fest there, and I know there's some good musicians there. You've got actually a pretty good scene there, right?
Yes, we do. It's actually a band show, and so we're going to put it some good use, I hope.
That's great. Well, good luck with the event, Dan. I hope you get good weather for that. So, yeah, it seems like a lot of cities are realizing, hey, we've got a good music scene here, Chelsea, and they're figuring out ways to showcase it.
Absolutely. I love that, taking advantage of that and promoting local musicians. That's great.
And there's the Mile of Music in the Fox Cities, Oshkosh, I think it's in?
Yeah, Appleton.
Appleton,
I think. Yeah, that never gets enough attention. That's a really fabulous festival that maybe it's getting more attention now as more people are hearing about it, but totally worth checking out.
All right, we'll go back to our callers. Morgan is on the line in Burlington. Morgan, hi.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Good. What do you want to recommend, Morgan?
Well, you guys are talking about a fantastic topic, and I'm calling in about the Burlington Tall Tales Music Festival. It's in its 4th season here.
Tall Tales Music Festival. What's behind that name?
The Tall Tales Music Festival is taking place in Burlington the second weekend of August, and this was a local music festival set up by our community to help better and bolster our music programs in the public school system.
Okay. No, I was asking about the name, Tall Tales. What does that mean?
Well, the Tall Tales is it's about the family and the gathering of the community, and music is about telling stories.
Oh, great. Okay, I get it now. Morgan, thank you so much. Good luck with that event, 4th year there. So there's another one of those, Chelsea, highlighting the music, and it sounds like family-friendly, too.
Yeah, you know, also, I don't know if this is related, but Burlington has their Liars Club, the Burlington Liars Club, and they host like a Tall Tales contest every year, so that might be related to the Tall Tales name.
I bet that is connected. Morgan, thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. 1234. Mary is with us next in Madison. Mary, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to let folks know that there's an outdoor skills-oriented event happening this weekend at Poinette at the McKenzie Environmental Education Center. It's hosted by the Pope and Young folks. It's called a Pope and Young Rendezvous, and that is related to deer hunting, but there's going to be archery and some hands-on activities. I'm going to be there all 3 days. It's goes through Sunday, doing waterfowl identification. So it's family-oriented and hands-on. And if people were to Google Pope and Young Rendezvous Poinette, they can find out more of the activities that are happening there.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun, Mary. How long has this been around?
I believe this might be the first year.
The first one. Great.
I think so. This is the first year I'm involved in it. At the McKenzie Center, we usually run the Youth Expo mid-May, and where we invite 4th and 5th graders. So that's not open to kids. But this, I believe, is the first year that this is happening at McKenzie Center.
Mary, thanks. So that's a different theme, Chelsea, educational, environmental, outdoor conservation education. Do we have other ones like that?
Yeah, that's really great. I love the McKenzie Center. There's always something going on up there on the weekends. And in fact, you know, most state parks or even local parks or local nature centers have guided hikes and other educational programs, whether it's fishing or, like she mentioned, archery. So, yeah, usually if you if you just head to your local park or nature center on the weekend, there's bound to be something going on.
Mary, thanks a lot for that. We're talking about outdoor festivals this summer in Wisconsin. Chelsea Lewis is our guest. She's with Wisconsin Trails, writes for the Journal Sentinel as well. She wrote a piece on some of the big and small festivals around the state, and we're taking your recommendations, your favorites, your local festivals at 800-642-1234. Sharon joins us next in Minocqua. Sharon, hi.
Hi, hello. I'm just calling to remind people about the Beef-O-Rama that's in Minocqua. It's one of the longest ongoing festivals in the state. I think last year was the 40th anniversary. It's very fun. It's very unique. Different organizations. People donate these roast beefs that all these organizations then cook in a barbecue grill, like in front of a business. Then everyone parades their beef through the streets, and then they go to Torpy Park, where the beef is sliced up and served as sandwiches to the public. It's just very unusual. It draws 10,000 people into little downtown Minocqua. So
Sharon,
it's just a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. Wouldn't be a festival conversation without Beef-O-Rama. We have a child of Minocqua sitting across at the board, Michelle Good here. And I've played at Minocqua. The town is crazy for Beef-O-Rama. Chelsea, I recommend it. Have you been there?
Yeah, my folks have a place in Hazelhurst, which is just south of Minocqua. So we love Beef-O-Rama. That's a ton of fun.
All right, Sharon, thanks so much. Enjoy Beef-O-Rama later this year. Eric is with us next in Sturgeon Bay. Eric, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your festival?
I wanted to mention the Steel Bridge Songfest. It's in Sturgeon Bay, and the outdoor portion of it is this Saturday and Sunday, actually. And what it is it takes place at the Holiday Music Motel, and they actually shut the place down and fill it with songwriters who write and record music all week, inspired by the community and the street Steel Bridge.
And that is there something with that tonight, too?
Mm-hmm. Tonight there is some stuff going on, but it's in a pub crawl along 3rd Avenue in Sturgeon Bay.
But the main event is this weekend.
Right. And the stuff that they've written and recorded will take place in the main event on that Saturday and Sunday outdoor stage. And they have, food and music, beer.
That sounds fantastic, Eric. Thank you so much. So music's actually created at the Steel Bridge Songfest in Sturgeon Bay. Chelsea, again, I don't know, Wisconsin's going to be the next big music scene with all these music festivals going on.
Yeah. We already had Summerfest for a while, but now there are all these little ones popping up. And the Steel Bridge one has been going on for a while. It's really cool. The Holiday Music Motel up there is just a really cool joint run by a couple of singer-songwriters, and they started putting this on. It's a great music festival.
Let's get to another caller or two. Thanks for that, Eric. Jim in Rice Lake next. Jim, hi.
What I'm plugging is it's the Twin Ports. It's Duluth, but it's also Superior.
Sure.
It's the Duluth Blues Festival in mid-July. It's probably one of the best blues music festivals in the Midwest in the country. And the Twin Ports has an enormous amount of opportunities in terms of sightseeing, boating, canal, park, etc. And so it's an opportunity to see a first-class music festival and have a really nice Twin Ports area to explore. Plus, not to mention Lake Superior.
Yeah, having a big lake in the background never hurts, does it, Chelsea?
Absolutely. It's such a beautiful area up there.
All right. Kathy is with us next in Mineral Point. Kathy, hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling to promote Shake Rag Alley's garden tour, which is June 18th. It's Saturday. We have 7 homes in Mineral Point, all beautiful homes and beautiful gardens. That will be on the tour, and it will be followed up or during the tour by a plant and yard art sale at Shake Rag Alley. Not only do we have all the gardens, but all those wonderful historic homes, so we invite everyone to come.
Kathy, thanks a lot for that garden tour in Mineral Point. Not time to bring them on, but Steve in Rome, Wisconsin, is throwing in the world's greatest junk parade. Evidently, they're junk vehicles, tractors, and bulldozers, everybody in costume. That one sounds great, too. So, Chelsea, we could quit our day jobs and spend all of our time traveling from festival to festival. What's next on your list? What are the next couple you're looking forward to?
Yeah, I really love Bastille Days here in Milwaukee. It's a French-themed festival in July, and they put up this kind of mock Eiffel Tower and Cathedral Square, and there's French food and music, and that I really love that little festival.
Well, Chelsea, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Chelsea Lewis. She writes about travel and things to do in Wisconsin for Wisconsin Trails in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She gave us recommendations on festivals to check out around Wisconsin this summer based on a piece she wrote for Wisconsin Trails. We've got that linked on the Central Time Facebook page. While you're there, share your favorite festival, plug your local event. Again, that's the Central Time Facebook page. Two Wisconsin flags are facing calls for a redesign. There's an ongoing unofficial community contest to replace Milwaukee's current flag. It's been described as a hot mess. We'll talk about that, by the way, tomorrow afternoon here on the show. And a writer for the Isthmus newspaper in Madison says Wisconsin deserves a better state flag. He cites a ranking from a few years back saying we have one of the worst state flags in the country. I'm no flag expert, and I'm pretty bad at graphic design myself. But both of these flags, I'm looking at them, I printed off pictures, they really try to pack a lot in. They're really literal and they want to include everything. So on the Wisconsin flag, well, we had a big mining history, so there's a miner and there's a pickaxe and a shovel. There's farming, so there's a cornucopia, there's an arm with a hammer, and there's a sailor guy. It's really literal. And then Milwaukee, you know, there's a sheaf of grain, there's the waterfront, there's a stadium that isn't open anymore. There's a guy who looks like he's in some kind of flying saucer or something. I don't know what that commemorated. So, again, no flag expert, but it might be time for redesign, maybe a little less busy, a little less literal. So, again, we'll talk about that Milwaukee flag and the effort to replace it tomorrow. Stick around. There's more to come today here on Central Time.